Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. The legislative session is getting underway this morning. We hear from the community about their hopes for this new year. We also look at the climate agenda. Could this be the year the governor's green fee gets the nod from state lawmakers? We pause to consider the beginnings of a garden and a conservation vision that is helping to pull communities together as we mark the year of our community forests. And a new exhibit to open this Friday could turn heads and get tongues wagging. We hear the story behind the Ali'i Gallery opening this weekend at Waterfront Plaza. It is Wednesday, January 15th. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It is opening day at the state legislature, and Hawaii Public Radio's reporters Ashley Mizua and Mark Ladau are at the state capitol covering the fanfare. And earlier this morning, they spoke to people as they gathered down in the rotunda about their hopes for the session.
My first name is Carrie Marquez, and I'm from Waimanalo. Well, I'm here to meet the representative on the west side. And what I want to do is, being that there's a lot that's going over on that side, you know, as far as, you know, shootings and very destructive things, God tugged at my heart and asked that I could go down and probably help them. So I'm trying to put a team together so that we can go down there and try to assist them in every way that we can possible.
And you're going to be here with some friends, right?
Yeah, okay. I'll be here with some friends as well.
Do you mind if I ask, do you have any specific legislators that you want to meet?
I'm not too sure as far as that, because I don't know the west side as well. You know, I'm just going to introduce myself and say, here I am, and please, if you could assist me, you know, in what my desires are for the people there.
So you live in Waimanalo, but you want to help the west side specifically.
Yes.
What's the connection, or how did you decide that you wanted to help the west side?
Well, the Lord has been just tugging at my heart. And I shared with my kahu, and he's at Kaneohe Congregational Church. So I shared with him, and he said, he'll assist me in every way possible. You know, so I'm happy about that. He's open, and he's willing to help out in any way that, you know, he could.
And they also spoke to Nikki Cristobal, who came to the Capitol with her young child to advocate against domestic violence.
I am here on behalf of an organization I work for, Pohana o Namahine, the first federally funded domestic violence resource center for Native Hawaiians. And I'm just here doing some advocacy for the work we do around gender-based violence.
Is this the first time that you've been to opening day at the legislature?
Yes. And the first time our organization has been at opening day as well.
Can you talk about maybe some of the policies that you're looking at introducing, or, you know, trying to shepherd through the legislative process?
Yeah, so we are advocating for policy changes specifically around things like overhauls of the Amber Miley Alert system to help identify more of our missing children more efficiently. Also looking to work on things like the age of consent issues. We're also looking to work on more housing solutions that are culturally appropriate, culturally grounded, and accessible and appropriate for survivors. There's a lot we're working on. A lot of stuff about data governance and just collecting better data about Native Hawaiians, and specifically Native Hawaiians who face specific types of violence.
And Robbie Melton is a familiar face at the Capitol. She was the former executive director of the High Technology Development Corporation, now working in agriculture. She said this was the fifth opening day session she'd attended.
I work for the Hawaii Agricultural Research Center, and we're just here to support agriculture. We do research, innovations, and making better plants and hardier plants. And it's just an exciting day to be here and hear what's new for the legislature.
Do you want to talk about maybe some of the priorities that you're going to be watching and looking at going into this legislative session?
Well, I think one of the main things for farmers is crime. You know, there's been a lot of agricultural theft, and the way situations are right now, it's very hard to catch the criminals. So that's one of the priorities. Also, we're up in Kunia, and we're looking to create an agricultural corridor so that it would reduce the speed limits on some of the areas, because some of the farmers can't even get out of their farms because people are speeding so much on the highways. So trying to institute safe driving so that it makes it easier for the farmers.
When you're talking about agricultural crime, what, I guess, in the current laws makes it difficult to prosecute?
It depends on where you are. So one, you have to catch the person in the act. And two, when they steal your crops, if you don't have any identifying marker, it's hard to say, hey, these are my, you know, oranges or tangerines. So that's a couple of the issues. And then, like for neighbor islands, if there's a crime, the police have to drive all the way to the farm, so there's the distance issue. So there's a lot of different issues around ag crime.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you thought would be important that you wanted to add?
No, I just wish all the legislatures well this year. I know it's a very hard job, and there's so many bills that you have to whittle it down and figure out what's priority.
And speaking of familiar faces, friends and families of lawmakers milled around, including an uncle of a new senator on the west side.
Aloha, my name is Herman Afua Keili'i Jr. I came here to support my niece, Samantha DeCorte, who's a Senate of the 22nd District. And we're just waiting and so blessed that my niece was able to be in the House of Senate.
And so you have family that's going to be here too, right?
They're all on their way. I'm one of the early birds.
What time is it now? Like 8:30-ish, I think?
Yeah.
It's pretty early.
Yeah. Well, I've been here since 7:30.
And finally, our reporter spoke with 12-year-old Alea Labo, a student at Kuaʻokala, a Hawaiian-focused charter school. Her teachers brought her class to the Capitol on a school field trip.
What are you doing here opening day today?
Today, we're just going to hang out, and we might go upstairs and talk to the House of Representatives.
What are you going to talk to them about?
Just issues in our community and issues with our school that we would like to improve. One of the main ones is the internet connection for a lot of the kids, because most of the kids in my community don't have internet at home. And recently our site got shut down for us to meet in person. So they're having a hard time doing their own homework. And that was an issue I wanted to talk about.
Is this the first time that you've been here at the Capitol?
Yes, my very first time.
How do you feel?
I feel excited, also a bit nervous because I don't know what's going to happen.
What got you guys involved with, you know, coming here today? Or is it part of a club? Or
I think my teachers just wanted to take us on a fun trip to learn about a little bit of our culture. And yeah, mostly to just have fun.
We have been hearing from community voices at the state capitol this morning. We'll have more legislative coverage coming up. Don't go away. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Live from the Atherton, HPR presents the return of our Mele Hawaii performance series. Performing live at our Honolulu studios are Kilia, Keauho, the Malie Lyman Quartet, and Hi'ikua. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Cades Foundation. Founded in 1991 by brothers Russell and Milton Cades, supporting Hawaii's communities for more than three decades. Cades.com/community.
climate issues are top of mind given the recent experience we had with the fires in Maui and as we watch the massive fire in Los Angeles continue to grow. Here to talk about the climate agenda is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes, yeah, so we understand that the lawmakers had a briefing yesterday.
Yes, that was called by Senator Mike Gabbard, who is the head of the Senate Committee on Environment and Agriculture. A lot of different departments and experts presented, including climatologist Chip Fletcher, who gave senators, I would say, a healthy dose of reality yesterday about global warming.
The data came out on Friday that last year, 2024, was the warmest year on record. The average surface temperature of the planet reached 1.6 degrees Celsius, breaking the United Nations threshold of 1.5 Celsius that all of the world's nations had pledged to work towards decreasing their greenhouse gases and stopping warming at 1.5. CO2 emissions are still rising around the world. Last year, the rate of CO2 accumulation in the atmosphere rose 86% above the previous year. This is the fastest in recorded history. Limiting warming to 1.5 degrees C would require global emissions reductions of 9% per year. This target is no longer practical. If you think of the COVID pandemic and the recession that was associated with that, emissions only went down 5.4%. And here, to stop at 1.5, they need to go down 9%. So this is no longer a practical target.
Well, that's a scary thought.
Yeah. Scientists largely concur that we're just missing the mark when it comes to reducing greenhouse gas emissions to keep global temperatures down, according to what countries across the world set out to do with that 1.5 degree Celsius mark. And that doesn't mean that it's time to call it a day on climate action. Every fraction of a degree that we can limit on global warming really, really matters. But we also have to prepare for the worst aspects of climate change, including stronger and more frequent storms and fires. We've experienced that on Maui. We're watching that unfold in Southern California, and that's just months after hurricanes hit the Southeast United States. These are very, very costly disasters. So Chip Fletcher is part of a six-person climate advisory team, which Governor Green convened last summer to research and then create policy recommendations on climate resilience and disaster preparedness. And their research indicates that the state may face $1.4 billion in property damages a year as a result of these kinds of natural disasters. Here's the climate team's chair, Chris Benjamin, talking about how they arrived at that number.
A lot of sophisticated modeling around the probability of storms, the nature of the structures in Hawaii, how many single wall construction homes are there, how many double wall construction, when were homes built, what were the codes at that time. There's a lot of sophisticated, really scientific modeling that underlies that. But then there's also some assumptions that you make about the frequency of the storms, where they hit, and that sort of thing. And so the actuaries run hundreds, if not thousands, of these models under various scenarios with storms of various magnitudes hitting in different places. So the $1.4 billion is probably a number that we may never hit in a particular year. Some years will be below that. Some years will be much higher than that. But that is what the model suggests we should expect on an annualized basis. So if you take that over 10 years, you're looking at $14 billion. But it's possible that we could have a storm next year that is twice that much, or it's also possible that we may not have a storm for several years. But it is a useful figure because it helps one appreciate the potential annual cost that we could incur if we're not adequately prepared for future disasters.
Yes, there is a lot of hand-wringing over the insurance costs and coverage that a lot of people are having a very difficult time getting.
Right, and Governor Green actually created a whole separate task force just to deal with that issue because there are so many aspects that climate change will affect. When you look at what the climate advisory team is rooting for, they are calling for the creation of two funds, which between them have close to $2 billion. So the first fund will go towards climate resilience projects, and the second fund will be used to make direct $20,000 payments to households that are affected by future disasters. And they proposed a number of ways to garner revenue for that fund, including a very familiar concept, which is the environmental stewardship fee, or a fee that we levied on visitors who access public lands. And this is something that Governor Green has been advocating since he took office. It's also sometimes known as a visitor fee or a green fee, but lawmakers have yet to go for it. So when I spoke to Denise Antolini, who's also a member of the climate team, I wanted to know what makes her think that this is the year that lawmakers are ready to pass that environmental stewardship fee.
Last year, after Lahaina, understandably, everyone was focused on the immediate disaster. Personally, I can't be critical of the lack of progress last year because it does take a long time to figure out how to move forward. But this really is the year to set the foundation for both resilience pre-disaster and post-disaster recovery. I think this is going to be a top priority for the legislature.
Yeah, so it's possible that this will be the year that we'll get that green fee in.
It does seem like it has some momentum. There are groups that are advocating at the Capitol today. Care for Ina Now Coalition rallied in favor of it. DLNR is advocating for it. Senator Mike Gabbard yesterday at the hearing says he doesn't understand why it has yet to pass.
Not an official poll, but I've been talking to tourists who come here, whether family or non-family members, and they're just saying, it's a no-brainer. And all these people, you had 10 million tourists in 2019, before the pandemic. They all want it. This is paradise. Hell yeah, we want to contribute.
Yeah, well, then it's looking good, so we'll see.
But even if we got that fee, that might not necessarily go to what the climate advisory team is envisioning. The DLNR has its own plans for how they would use that money. So there are other things that they are considering that could be piped into this fund, an increase in the transient accommodations tax, an increase on the barrel tax. And even though it's not one of their formal recommendations, they encourage people to pay attention to different cases that are making their way through the courts. So for instance, there are Honolulu City and County and Maui County as well, both have cases against several oil companies on the grounds that they misled the public about the relationship between fossil fuels on climate change. And there was a development this week where the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an appeal from those oil companies to block those cases. And so those lawsuits should now have a clear path to go to trial. And if such suits are successful, the oil industry may have to pay out billions of dollars in damages, and the climate team thinks the state should join in those cases and get in on that action.
So if the lawmakers are able to create these climate funds, who gets to decide where the money goes?
So that goes to another one of their recommendations, which is to create a new Hawaii Resilience Office. That's kind of the state-level equivalent of what Honolulu and other counties have. And I talked to Representative Nicole Lowen about that. She chairs the House Energy and Environment Committee, and she questioned whether it was necessary to have this new office to administer the state's climate efforts.
I mean, I think that it's worth having a conversation. I understand the intention behind it is coming from a good place, but we have a disaster management agency. We have Department of Land and Natural Resources that oversees some of these issues. We have Department of Health that oversees some of these issues. We have a climate commission that is involved in these issues. We have the Office of Planning and Sustainable Development. And now we have the Governor's Climate Advisory Team. So now we're looking at another entity. I mean, in addition, the Energy Office is sort of involved in some of the climate mitigation responsibilities. So I think there's a need to coordinate this, but whether that's accomplished by creating a new entity to add to the long list of entities already, I don't know.
Yeah, tough questions to deal with this session.
Certainly. And the stakes only get higher, for sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her coverage on climate issues this session on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihau, Umulokai, Ulanai, Umaui, Ukahoolabe, Uhawaii.
Since today marks the start of the legislative session, we thought we'd test your knowledge on some capital trivia. In 1969, the territorial and state legislatures moved from their old home at Iolani Palace to the state capitol building. A call was put out to architects around the world to design the $25 million project, including I.M. Pei, who designed the Louvre's Glass Pyramid, as well as the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. But the contract was awarded to a San Francisco architect, John Carl Warnecke. His firm took inspiration from the Hawaiian Islands and Native Hawaiian culture in the form of two symbolic numbers. These are the same numbers of pillars in front of the Capitol's entrances as there are panels in front of the governor's desk. For the second number, there are as many kukui trees in the courtyard as there are doorways to each chamber. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know, what are the two numbers found repeated throughout the design of the Hawaii State Capitol? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, nāreithawaii.com.
In this, the year of the community forest, we have been highlighting programs in place to help engage people across the state. This week, we've been showcasing the National Tropical Botanical Garden. It just marked a major milestone in its history. It covers gardens on Kauai, Maui, and Florida. Chipper Wickman has worked with the NTBG for 50 of its 60 years. He is hailing the vision of its founders and the many hands that work to conserve native species.
The garden was inspirational even when I started, and there were really only about 10 of us working. You know, we had one garden and it was a small organization, but the vision was always there. And I'm just in awe of our founders who, starting in the 1950s, you know, conceived of creating a national institution headquartered in Hawaii that was funded entirely with philanthropy. I mean, it's such an audacious vision and dream. But they were so smart in not wanting to be subject to the political winds that blow either in our state capital or in our national capital in Washington. It was a long haul, but the fact that we are entirely privately funded gives us a lot more sovereignty and stability in the work that we do, which is so critical for not only for Hawaii, but for the world. So really, I've been so honored to have been part of it for the past 50 years.
And we were fortunate to visit there, and, you know, with 2025 being designated as Year of the Community Forest, it really just shows how it takes everybody to keep our forests healthy.
Absolutely. It's remarkable, the conservation community and that has really pulled together to help conserve our community forests and to create new ones like breadfruit agroforests. It's very exciting to me to see how broad the support is for taking care of our plants, and especially the plants that support our fresh drinking water, that support our food supply, that support our other native species that are dependent upon them.
We'll talk a little bit about the ulu movement, because there is just so much synergy, I think, that is happening now, because being food secure is top of mind with all these disasters that we've seen. And it's really empowering our communities to get out there and do something and take control of, you know, what we put on our table.
Absolutely. You know, and breadfruit is a really great example of that. And again, I'm so impressed with the vision of our early founders and supporters who adopted breadfruit as the symbol of our organization in 1972. And that was long before, you know, anybody realized the potential of breadfruit to feed the world or to create food sovereignty for Hawaii. It's part of our icon. And we started developing a global collection of that in the early 70s. But it was really Diane Ragone and her PhD work in which she developed the global collection that we have now, which is over 150 different kinds of breadfruit collected from throughout the Pacific. It's a remarkable resource. And the fact that we have that genetic repository here in the Hawaiian Islands means that we have access to various kinds of breadfruit that can be grown under different soil conditions, different environmental conditions, wet, dry, salty, you name it. And to see breadfruit and its nutritious characteristics, it's really a superfood. And unlike most of the food crops that have fed humanity over millennia that need to be harvested and replanted, a breadfruit agroforest is basically a food forest. It's like a natural Walmart where you can go for all kinds of products, can last for, you know, a lifetime or more. There are breadfruit agroforests that have been in constant use for over 1,000 years in Micronesia. It's just remarkable to see the potential this plant has for Hawaii.
So do you have a favorite way of preparing breadfruit? Mine is with coconut milk, and you just bake it. I just love it.
That's an easy go-to. We like to also bake it in the oven. Just put it in the oven with a stick, cut out the core and put a stick of butter in it. And it's just delicious. It really depends on what stage you harvest your breadfruit at. If you like it a little bit softer and starch is starting to convert to sugar, it's almost more like a dessert with the butter in that. But my wife also makes a great breadfruit, harvested at a more immature stage, peels it, boils it, cuts it up, and it's just like artichoke heart you put in your salad. So it's a really amazing fruit.
Well, you know, when I went to the gardens recently, I was just impressed because you have this wonderfully designed building there overlooking the valley, Asaboff designed, and then you have the other building behind it designed by Dean Sakamoto. But it's just a wonderful setting and just a wonderful resource for the community.
It is. And, you know, the fact that even though we did not have very much money back in the early years, the fact that our board selected Val Ossipoff to come up with the campus for our headquarters and the design and his sighting of the buildings on the landscape with the views, it's really a remarkable facility. And then when Dean came along and designed our LEED Gold Botanical Research Center, it really complemented the Ossipoff design and created an absolutely unduplicated resource for our island. You know, there just isn't anything like it. So it's amazing what a resource it is for our community.
Well, and then you've got a wonderful landscape design garden as well.
Yeah, and Catherine, I'm not sure you've been to all of ours, but we have 5 different gardens, and each one is absolutely remarkable. So in addition to the 2 gardens in the Lauai Valley, Limahuli Garden and Preserve on the North Shore, just before Haena State Park, is absolutely one of the most spectacular gardens you'll see anywhere in the world. And Kahanu Garden on the island of Maui with Pi'ilani Haleheao as the crown jewel in the middle of it is also just incredible. I mean, it may be one of the few places left where you can stand on the coast, and as far as you can see, there's no sign of modern development. It's a remarkable cultural landscape.
And then you also have a property over in Florida.
That's right. 6 time zones and 5,000 miles away. And it also is really quite incredible. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. It was the home of Dr. David Fairchild, who was the first director of the Office of Plant and Seed Importation for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Today, we have partnered with Florida International University and built the International Center for Tropical Botany at the Kampong there. So it's a remarkable property that's really contributing significantly to the global challenges we face.
Well, it's nice to think that, yeah, we have these treasures on our islands and in Florida. And, you know, if people want to learn more about it, I mean, folks can go island hopping and appreciate what we've got here.
Absolutely. You know, in many ways, I think we're kind of a best kept secret. And for years, most people didn't really even realize that we existed here. Over the last 10 years, we've really tried to get more people into our gardens to really appreciate not only the beauty of them, but the importance of the work that we're doing. And today we host probably around 70 to 80,000 people a year, which is small compared to large botanic gardens around the world on the continent. But for us, that's a large number of people, and we're just so thrilled to be able to share what we do with the broader public.
Well, Chipper, thank you so much for your time and for sharing the story of the gardens with our listeners.
Well, thank you for featuring us and bringing it to awareness of your audience. You have a great following, and I'm one of them. I love to listen to your show at 11 every day. Thank you so much, Catherine.
That was Chipper Wickman, former president and CEO of the National Tropical Botanical Garden. You know, as the garden is marking 60 years, we're digging into our archives to showcase a conversation we had with the director emerita of the NTBG Breadfruit Institute. Many regard Diane Rangoni as the mother of the breadfruit movement. We talked to her in 2020 when she was still the director of the Breadfruit Institute.
I became involved in breadfruit knowing nothing about it. I moved to Hawaii in 1979, and then I sampled it once. And I was a graduate student at the University of Hawaii in the horticulture department, interested in tropical fruits. And I decided to write a paper for a class on breadfruit in Tahiti, where it's an important center. And it was from that term paper where I went to the UH library, which has this incredible collection, the Pacific Collection, and found all this wonderful, interesting information about breadfruit, its uses, the cultural, the historical aspect. And from that, I decided that is what I wanted to do for my PhD. I wanted to study breadfruit varieties in the Pacific Islands.
So what is it about the history, I think, that you've just found the most interesting?
The history I found so interesting was just how widely grown breadfruit was throughout the Pacific Islands and how important it was culturally and as a staple food for so many Pacific Islanders for centuries. And the thing that interested me at that time, because it was so new to me, was I was interested in plant introductions. And so the thing about breadfruit was there was interest in the 1920s and then again right after World War II from botanists and scientists recognizing that traditional crops and cultivation practices in the Pacific Islands were at risk and that varieties of breadfruit and other crops were in danger of disappearing. And so I approached it from that perspective, this need to collect and conserve and document breadfruit diversity. Hawaii has one variety of breadfruit traditionally, so it was fascinating for me to learn that there were places in the Pacific that had documented 50, 60, even 100 varieties of breadfruit.
And then you've tasted them all, and you have favorites.
So my work was not just to collect the varieties and document them, but to collect propagating material, because it was a conservation effort to conserve these traditional varieties. So I planted the trees at the National Tropical Botanical Garden, Kahanu Garden, Maui, and over the years as the trees grew and started fruiting, we were able to, you know, document and do research on the collection. But yes, I harvested and sampled the different varieties to see what they were like. So every time I would go to Hana, I live on Kauai, I would harvest 3, 4, 5 different varieties and just steam them and cook them and eat them and see how they tasted. So,
and your favorites?
My favorites, is it like picking which child's your favorite? I have 3 to 5 favorites. So there, a couple of them are Samoan varieties. One is called Puo, and it's a variety that's been in Hawaii for at least 100 years. There's another Samoan variety called Ma'afala, and that's a variety I like very much. They're both very flavorful. They are both very nutritious. There's a very unusual variety that I was able to rescue from an abandoned breadfruit conservation collection in Samoa. It's from Rotuma, and its name is Ulufiti, which means from Fiji. And then there are a couple of the Micronesian varieties. You're from Guam, Lamai?
Lamai.
Lamai. the Micronesian varieties from mainly Ponape and Chuuk. In 2011, with the Hawaii Homegrown Food Network, the Breadfruit Institute launched a program called Ho'ulu Ka'ulu to revitalize breadfruit in Hawaii. So we did five festivals on two islands, many workshops, cooking demonstrations, and so a way to encourage and make people more aware of breadfruit and also making trees available. So, you know, and getting the nurseries to propagate trees. So that was an important part of it too. You have to have the trees available. So tens of thousands of trees have been planted in Hawaii in the past decade through these efforts. And now all these people now have access to fruit they didn't before. And so the farmers need entrepreneurs, they need businesses to develop products. So that's what we're seeing now through these cook-offs and these other activities, entrepreneurs and other people throughout Hawaii are starting, and chefs, can't forget the chefs, are using breadfruit and putting it on their menus. People are making products. So we're seeing new novel food products and seeing breadfruit used in restaurants and more in homes. And the thing that's most dear to my heart is this economic development is so important. We need to diversify agriculture in Hawaii, and this is an important cultural crop that could do so. But local family and community food security and self-sufficiency, and having more breadfruit trees planted in more yards and more communities like the Ho'ula community, where then a family can harvest and eat fruit and excess fruit they can give to their friends or their family, sell it. So there is that local abundance, not just a commercial opportunity.
And that was part of a conversation from September 2020 when we were out and about with Diane Rangoni, who many regard as the mother of the breadfruit movement. Tomorrow we venture out of the garden and head to the Big Island, where we check in with the Ula Cooperative to talk about its efforts to bring breadfruit products to market as Hawaii works to become more food secure across the state. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute, and we've got a song that you're sure to recognize. It's from one of the most common songbirds in the islands, the house finch. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo biology professor Patrick Hart.
The house finch was first introduced to Oahu around 1870 and soon spread to all the other Hawaiian islands. It is now one of our most widely distributed birds. It can be commonly found at sea level on all the main Hawaiian islands, then Mauka through pastures, woodlands, and wet forests, all the way up to subalpine forests above 9,000 feet elevation on Maui and Hawaii. Some people in Hawaii call them papaya birds, or manuai mikana, because of their habit of eating soft fruits such as papaya in backyards and orchards, but they also love insects, as well as seeds of all kinds, and can be commonly found at bird feeders. They're about 5 inches long from bill to tail and are sexually dimorphic, meaning males and females look very different. While both sexes are mainly brown with pale streaks, the males have a head and chest that ranges in color from yellow-orange to bright red, with the color dependent on the level of carotenoid pigments they get in their food. House finch song has been described as a sweet warble and can be heard throughout the year in Hawaii. Songs are generally sung by the males, either to attract females or as a form of aggression directed at other males. They can sing while they're perched and even while they're flying. House finch calls, on the other hand, are a rather nasally cheep and are given by both males and females when they're foraging to let each other know where they are. House finch are one of the most common and widely distributed birds across North America. Until recently, they were thought to be the closest living relative to our native Hawaiian honeycreepers. Recent molecular evidence, though, indicates that this distinction now belongs to the closely related rose finch, which is only found in Eurasia. About 7 million years ago, a small flock of these rose finch somehow crossed more than 2,500 miles of ocean, landed in what we now call Hawaii, and evolved into our more than 56 species of honeycreepers, many of which, though, have unfortunately gone extinct. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, devoted to conserving the unique flora and fauna of Hawaii Island. More about giving at friendsofhakalauforest.org.
Join Hawaii Public Radio in Wailuku for a celebration of Maui's abundant mo'olelo and mele. Maui Mele Memories is our talk story event on Saturday, January 25th at 1 p.m. at the Maui Academy of Performing Arts. Award-winning musician Kamaka Kehau Fernandez will join HPR's DJ Mermaid for a conversation. RSVP for free at hprtickets.org.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the architectural history of the state capitol building. Designed by a San Francisco-based firm, the building features two sets of numbers that repeat throughout the design. The first of these numbers represent the major Hawaiian islands, while the other number represents the state's counties and the major Hawaiian gods. You'll find those digits all over the building. For instance, in the number of pillars outside the entrances to the Capitol, the panels on the governor's desk, even the number of kukui trees in the courtyard, and the number of windows on each side of the chambers. We asked you what these two significant numbers were. We were looking for 8 and 4. And we have no winners today. We stumped you on that one. But that's our quiz. If you have one you'd like to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. There is a new exhibit that opens Friday in Kaka'ako that features Hawaii's ali'i in a new light. It uses high-tech advances to present the monarchy to a new audience, and it may spark conversations about how and why. Etienne Aurelius is a native Hawaiian filmmaker. He was born on the Big Island, raised on Kauai homestead land, and is behind what is billed as the Ali'i Atlas of the Royal Gallery of the Hawaiian Kingdom. He joined us in the studio earlier this morning to talk about connecting his passion for culture and his high-tech skills in what he calls a new interactive archive about Hawaii's monarchs.
Well, about 3 years ago, I just had finished making my second movie, and I was just scrolling through all the advertising in and available online and what they're branding the Hawaiian culture with. And I noticed that every single commercial had not one Hawaiian in it. And it got really, worrisome for me. And I realized that one of the biggest problems of the decline in Hawaiian culture and the familiarity of it to the world has a lot to do with modern day mo'olelo, which is us, influencers, creators, because the world views Hawaii through social media, through YouTube, and if all they're doing is like jumping off of cliffs and running through the beautiful land, then our culture becomes just a piece of land with people having fun on it instead of culture. And so I really wanted to take it to a place where I brought my skills from, you know, that I've learned with Jason Momoa and years of creating documentaries for people here in Hawaii to uplift them and basically make them famous and give them an identity to the world. And I realized the only thing making them famous was the culture. It was always the culture. I was always putting like a mask of aloha on them. And it was a Turtle Bay commercial that really pushed me over the edge because it was so far from who we are. And before I had left to work with Jason, I had made a Turtle Bay commercial using all locals. And when you really think about the broad spectrum of things, the globe, the world, views Hawaii from movies, people who become rapidly famous. So when you look at the grand spectrum, you got Dwayne Johnson, Jason Momoa, and movies like 50 First Dates. And so for the last 5 years, everything you've seen of Jason, I've created, whether we are Mauna Kea, his YouTube channel, all branded with aloha at the core. And when you think of the global view, given he's the biggest actor in the world, that became the perspective people saw Hawaii for. So when I came back home, I realized the impact that I had made and decided that the culture is going to be my number one client now.
And so you are centering this exhibit around the ali'i. What can people expect when they walk in the door there on Friday?
To be completely enthralled with being able to look into their eyes. That's my number one thing. They have eye, like the black and white images have turned into eyes, like colored eyes, smiles, their teeth. We spent a lot of time facial mapping where their lips sat in the photos to kind of depict what kind of teeth they were. And also like using genealogy, you know, certain Hawaiians have teeth that go in, like my auntie guys. You can tell by the jaw. So there's a lot of like research that goes into it. And they are the most realistic depictions of who they are. And they're even animated. I have them smiling and laughing as if they were captured yesterday.
Okay, so how would you describe this technology? Is it like what we were hearing, the holograms, you know, like with Whitney Houston or, you know, I think what was the one that was controversial, Prince?
Yeah.
Is it that kind of thing?
It's like a mix between Pixar animation and Weta Digital, which is the Lord of the Rings, Avatar. They're an indigenous post house collective in New Zealand. They're one of the biggest in the world. They made my first movies CGI, and a man by the name of Darwin Goh, who's a visual effects supervisor, licensed me a program that they use, that they invented, that facial reconstructs sketches into real faces. So I ran all the monarchs' photos that they had and the sketches and laid them over one another, and then the program gets to work. And it like sources like literal genealogy of people's skins and eyes, and it applies all these things. So they have pores in their faces, and it's we revamped the entire Hawaiian photographic library, giving the Hawaiian history a new facelift. From now on, when they tell Mo'olelo on the news or hotels want to tell stories, it's in full 8K color, real resolution, as if they're taken yesterday.
So the ali'i will basically come alive in this exhibit.
Yeah, literally, they're laughing and smiling, and I've seen a couple of videos where they're crying, and people use AI to do that. Well, the AI, it's easy to do. AI is getting pretty great. It can literally do CGI, but it has a problem with hands. Like the hands always look weird and their faces have a certain look, right? And I wanted to not have that at all. I wanted to animate them to be real, you know, teeth and all that
right.
stuff.
Right. Well, okay, so the technology is out there and can do it, but some might ask, well, should we do it? And should we be bringing the ali'i to life? That it might make some people uncomfortable.
For sure. I know for a fact people will be uncomfortable, but then I have to just chalk it up to, what are you doing to perpetuate and preserve our culture? Because when that lady said Hawaiian's a dead language, that's one of the reasons why I built the Echo 3 years ago, because I saw it becoming one. Here's a statistic. When Prince Kohio did the Hawaiian Homes bill, there were 30,000 Hawaiians alive, and all 30,000 spoke Olelo. Today, there's 640,000. More than 400,000 do not live here. The rest that live here make up for 75% of the homeless population. 80% are middle class, and there are barely any above or near the one tax bracket. So in that sense, out of all 640,000 people, there are 2,000 people that speak Olelo fluently, like proper. Most of them are in the Big Island, or they went to that one school like Kamaka Diaz did. 2,000 people out of 640,000.
Okay, so your concern is that you want to elevate culture and
archive.
Showcase that in this exhibit.
Yes. Archive the culture. My company Echo is an archive, like first and foremost. We have the largest living Native Hawaiian life story testimony archive in the world of living people. And we now revamped the entire 600 photographed library from the 1700s to the 1900s, because people own rights to those, right? But in the Library of Congress, if you change seven things, which I changed 40, I can now give it back to the people to use and create. Hawaiian culture is the most lucrative culture in the world. Like, we have gods like the Greek gods. We have wars like Alexander the Great. We have a philosophy that is superior to any governance from beyond the ali'i system to the ohana system, where there was no leaders, just teachers. He ali'i kaina ke kawa ke kanaka, land is chief, man is servant, was the law, and aloha was an education. It was a state of mind. And once the high council could see, oh, he's acting with it, right? And acting with aloha is every decision you make, you stop, retract the action, check the boxes off. Does this match with aloha? Then act. Then you graduate. Then you can call yourself a Hawaiian, because these people were coming from all over the Pacific.
Okay, so did you check yourself? Did you have your aloha checklist when you put this exhibit together?
Yeah. For me, everything I do, as long as it's in the perpetuation of the culture, is the right thing. I don't care what anyone says. As long as I am telling our culture accurately, because it's all wrong. You know, like all of it.
So what are you going to say, let's say when the show opens on Friday and there are critics about how you present this, how do you respond?
I'll say, let's have a conversation. I'm sure I'll learn stuff from them, but I'm sure they will also learn stuff from me. But I know so much about the culture beyond the books. Like my kahuna, Pony Kahu, taught me about the land of Mu, the original Hawaiians. And the gallery are interactive art pieces. So you can go out, you can go there, see all 30 ali'i. There's a plaque that's brass. You scan that QR code and it's going to take you to the biggest open source biography of each monarch. So you could get a better degree in Hawaiian studies in that hallway than you could get at a school, because we're sourcing from all the archivists, like multiple archivists.
Okay,
so
it's an entry point for people to learn more.
Educational art. And then we're going to do like 80-foot Kalakaua on Kalakaua Avenue, 80-foot Prince Kohio with those codes. And then the goal is to get the ali'i in the city big, so we can start celebrating. We have kings, queens. Our culture is so beautiful.
That was Etienne Aurelis, the force behind a new interactive exhibit and archive. It's called the Ali'i Atlas of the Royal Gallery of the Hawaiian Kingdom, and it opens this Friday at the Kaka'ako Waterfront Plaza at 6 p.m. The Hawaiian monarchs are to come to life using Pixar and Technicolor facial reconstruction programs. It is expected to be unlike anything you've seen before. Look for links on our website later today. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to hear from Governor Josh Green. Got questions for him about fireworks or the green fee? Record something on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our shows archived online by searching for The Conversation. We are also on Spotify and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.